The Rubik's Cube is one of the most popular and beloved yet most frustrating puzzles ever created. The simply designed six-sided multicolored device has stumped millions of people around the world. It's one of the all-time best-selling children's toys, but also a symbol of intellectual prowess. And people competing in world tournaments can solve these cubes in less than 10 seconds. In Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast, and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving, Ian Scheffler explores the history, competitions, and community of Rubik's Cubing. It's published by Touchstone, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Where did the Rubik's Cube come from?
So it came from a very unlikely place. It was invented by a 29-year-old man living at home with his mom in communist Hungary. And given that it was such a successful commercial product, it's perhaps unsurprising that when he was once giving some off-the-cuff remarks, Ronald Reagan assumed it had been made in America and used it as an example of the brilliance of capitalism. And someone had to say, oh, actually, it's from communist Hungary.
How did the puzzle, this toy or device, I don't know what we want to call it, become an international phenomenon if it was created in then communist Hungary?
Well, it's a very circuitous, it's one of those very just kind of circumstantial wild stories involving a Holocaust survivor who married into the British aristocracy and started a toy business. That was actually one of the questions I had when I started this book was like, you know, if it has this history, this is where it came from, how did I wind up, you know, with me as a kid in California?
And how did Erno, did you ever find an answer?
Yeah. I mean, if finding out how it got out, there's certainly a very clear narrative there. This man named Tom Kramer, who was born in Transylvania and actually interned in the same camp where Anne Frank later perished, he was able to get out and wound up going to Israel and then South Africa and then Britain, where he married into an aristocratic family. He now lives in like a Downton Abbey style estate. You know, Rubik's Cube has done very well for him.
So he's the one who marketed it, not Erno Rubik.
Well, Rubik first went to a communist toy collective that didn't really know what it was doing, and you know, cubes were produced, but ironically, very few people, no one knew how to solve it to demonstrate it. So it was not a very winning presentation.
But he must have known how to solve it.
Yes.
How did he even come to create it? What was his intention?
So Mr. Rubik is a lot like his own puzzle. I mean, if you ask 10 people the same question about him, you're liable to get 10 different answers, which can't all possibly be true. For instance, he himself has confirmed and denied at different times that he created it as a teaching device. And he gave me kind of a third answer once, which was, well, one of its applications is teaching, which neither confirms nor denies. But the what seems to be the case is that he's someone who has a mind with many sides to it, so to speak. He's, you know, interested in literature and art and science. His father was an engineer and his mother was a poet. So he's literally the union of art and science.
And has he created other puzzles?
He has developed other products. The Rubik's Company has licensed many others as well, including larger cubes and the Rubik's Magic. But this is really his masterpiece.
How would it be used as a teaching device?
Well, so there's actually a class at UC Berkeley in the math department which involves Rubik's Cube. Rubik's Cube embodies some very complex mathematics called group theory, which a lot of us embody every day when we say, like, you know, get something out of the fridge. You're doing a group theory operation called conjugation, where you do an operation, another operation, and invert the first operation. You open the fridge door, get the sandwich out, close the fridge. This shows up in Rubik's Cubes. That operation shows up in computer science. You know, and the benefit is that it allows you to change something and protect what you've already solved.
I remember when I got a Rubik's Cube, I can't remember how many years ago it was, but when it first came on the market, I think I solved it, and then I got bored.
Fair enough. I first want to say it's really impressive that you solved it. Did you just figure that out totally on your own?
Yeah, I think it may have been by accident, but I wound up doing it.
Okay. Yeah, that is really impressive because the
maybe I'm smart. I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. It takes a certain competitive bent of mind to get into doing this for fun. The young man who taught me many years ago, I'd happen to sit next to the greatest Rubik's Cube solver in the world at summer camp. He's so competitive that when he got married, and this is on YouTube, people can check it out, he didn't do a dance with his wife because, like, they met at a cubing competition and they like cubing and jujitsu. They don't like dancing. So in front of the whole wedding party, they dragged out a wrestling mat and created the sport of cube jitsu, where you either get the other person to submit like they put on their, you know, wrestling gear and everything, or you solve the cube. So like they're trying to fight each other with a cube in one hand, and with his now wife choking him out as he's losing consciousness, my old friend like solves it one-handed and gets the win.
They could have done a Cuban dance.
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, how long after you were introduced to it did you solve your first cube?
So I first encountered it as a thing much the way Mr. Rubik did. He invented it by accident, actually, and didn't realize it was a puzzle at first. I saw one at a gift shop as a kid. And
how old were you?
I was like 8 or 9 growing up in L.A. in the 90s. I mean, ironically, I never was around in the 80s when it first was big, but I didn't know it was a puzzle at first. I twisted it up and then couldn't put it back together and never figured it out. But when I saw it again at summer camp, this kid I sat next to could do it under the table without looking at it. He was later hired to teach Will Smith for The Pursuit of Happiness. He taught me how to do it in a couple weeks during camp, and then it was years later I found out about the competitions.
Are there any basic rules or principles that we should follow to solve them?
Yes. There's many, many different ways to solve the cube. The one I use is sort of like building a layer cake. You divide it into layers and go from the bottom to the top. But no matter what method you use, something a lot of people don't realize is that the center of each face dictates what color the face needs to be, because if you take this apart, there's axles inside the puzzle that fix the center pieces in place relative to one another. So if you're looking at, you know, people try to build that one side is one color, but you might get stuck if you don't realize, oh, the red side's opposite the orange side.
You stopped playing it for a while you were in high school, and then you returned to it. What got you back?
So I found out just by chance that there were competitions that I had no idea. I got wind of the national championship, which was happening in a dumpy casino in Vegas where Liberace used to hold court. And lo and behold, the kid who taught me, a young man named Toby Mao, was one of the organizers. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, no big, my brother and I basically created the FIFA of Rubik's Cubes. And they're less corrupt because they have far less money, but they're in like 77 countries now, I think, and they have 60,000 members. And I said, can I write about it? And he was like, you're not going to compete? Years earlier, he challenged me to go under 20 seconds, which is kind of like the 4-minute mile of solving a cube. So I said, challenge accepted.
Well, if everybody who is in competition can do it in under 20 seconds or under 10 seconds, then what kind of competition is it?
Not everybody can do it that fast.
The people who compete, I would assume, would be the fastest.
Yeah, well, there's a pretty big gradation in terms of, like, I think I rank around the 80th percentile worldwide, but, like, the divide even among the top 10 people is huge. It's sort of like the way in track and field, like, there's a lot of fast people, but if you go to the Olympics, Usain Bolt is head and shoulders above everybody else.
My guest is Ian Scheffler. His book, Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast, and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. A lot of fans at these events? Are the top players treated like celebrities?
Absolutely. They often get asked to sign cubes. I mean, it's gotten to the point where there are sponsored cubers who show up with jerseys as if they were in like NASCAR or something. Like one kid from Holland even has an eponymous puzzle now called The Valk, which it's like he helped design it. It's named after him. It's like a special cube designed for speed. So, they have pretty big followings. It's very big in China. The recent Asian championships had almost 1,000 competitors and many, many spectators.
So cubes have been invented to help the players go faster. What would change? After all, it's still pretty much the same puzzle.
Yes. So, you'd look at this and in the same way you'd say, oh, that's Kleenex, even if it's just generic facial tissue, you'd call it a Rubik's Cube. But the interior is machined differently. It's got a different design so that you can turn it faster, because at top speed, the best guys are doing, 14 different operations a second, which is as fast as a slow hummingbird.
Have any methods like algorithms been created to help solve the cube faster?
Yeah. So every time you make a move in a sequence, you're doing an algorithm. I mean, algorithms are kind of all around us. Tying your shoes is an algorithmic process. You've got an input, which is untied shoelaces. You do your steps, you got tied shoelaces. So it's actually a lot like playing a jazz solo to solve a cube, because the same way a jazz musician has chords and scales and like these sort of concrete elements they know, but they're always remixing it. I know algorithms for, say, like swapping three edges or exchanging corner pieces, but it's never the same sequence of using those.
In competitions, often there are psychological factors. Does that apply with cubing?
Absolutely. A former national championship champion from New Jersey named Andy Smith he gets very nervous before he solves, so he's got his own custom handkerchief to wipe his hands before every round. It's got a cube embroidered on it.
But do people psych out the competition?
So as I write about in the book, the Cuban could have taken a very different path. It's very communitarian. It's very supportive. There was a man who revitalized the cubing in the early 2000s, and like his goal was to have a much more hard-nosed competitive style where, like, as he put it to me, you'd never get 5-second solves in his way. He'd be shaking people up.
What's the current world record?
So it was actually just broken by a cuber in Australia. It's down to 4.73 seconds.
That's the kind of record that can be broken.
Yeah, well, it was
4.2 seconds.
Yeah, well, it was just lowered from 4.74, and before that it was 4.9, so it just keeps falling.
You mentioned a 12-year-old phenom named Zemdegs?
Yeah.
Who got into speed cubing when he was introduced to it by watching Dan Brown's 2007 YouTube video called How to Solve a Rubik's Cube. The internet must be playing a role in getting more people into cubing.
Absolutely. I mean, without the internet, there's no way it would have come back the way it has because, you know, I know there were guides in the 80s, but clearly there was a lot of frustration. I found an old product called the Cube Smasher, which really got a patent and was distributed, and it had a manual about how different many ways you could destroy this puzzle.
Because you're frustrated and
exactly.
Angry.
Yeah, now you can just go on YouTube and find a tutorial and meet other people who like to do it and go to competitions.
The first World Rubik's Cube Competition Championship was held in 1982. I'd imagine the winner was a lot slower. What did that look like?
So that was largely a promotional stunt put on by someone hired by the Cube Company, a guy who'd made a name for himself doing things like staging Monopoly tournaments inside nuclear power plants in England with people, you know, wearing hazmat suits and stuff. And so that drew together, like, I think 19 national champions from around the world, and it was won by a young man from the U.S. who, only a year before, he's got a wild story, and I got to speak with him. He was one of the boat people. He was a refugee from Vietnam, and within a year, he went from living Gilligan's Island style in Malaysia to being the world Rubik's Cube champion.
You mentioned that you went to Budapest to meet Erno Rubik, and he's kind of enigmatic.
Absolutely. I like to say he's sort of like the Willy Wonka of Eastern Europe. He's very wealthy, very reclusive, very brilliant. It took me 2 years to get a one-hour sit-down interview with him.
How important is the Rubik's Cube to the people of Hungary? Are they aware or proud of its origins?
Extremely. It used to be on the stamps. And in fact, you can still wander Budapest and see the cube all over the place. The same way in New York, you've got Empire State Building and Statue of Liberty merchandise. There's, you know, Rubik's Cube keychains, magnets, even underwear. And everyone knows who Rubik is, although I was under the impression, speaking to people, that most of them assumed he'd passed away by this point, which is not true.
How old is he?
He's in his early 70s.
Uh-huh. Well, not that old.
No.
He could probably come up with another invention somewhere down the line. You competed in the 2015 World Rubik's Cube Competition in Brazil.
Yes.
How did you do?
I was going for that under 20-second goal. And I didn't quite make it there because in competition, it's hard to deal with the nerves. You got hundreds of people watching you and you're trying to solve a Rubik's Cube on stage. I did have the fun experience of getting to sit next to the youngest cuber in the world, who at the time I think was 3 or 4, a girl from Brazil. And
three or four?
Yeah, she can do it under a minute. She's got a bit of a stage parent, but she's really great. They had to bring, I think, 4 chairs to stack high enough for her to reach the table.
Is this like other competitions? Do people train?
Oh, absolutely. People train, people, you know, do averages of like 10,000 solves to get ready. I mean, people do all kinds of things. The first modern world champion, the things he would do to train his nerves are like, you know, go skydiving and not pull the chute till he'd solved the cube.
What's the most significant cubing advice you've been given?
It's the subtitle, to go fast, you have to go slow. I heard lots of cubers.
I don't know what that means.
Right. So have you ever had a moment where you're sort of in the zone, whether it's with music or dance or something, or you're just kind of in the moment and time kind of expands?
Mm-hmm.
Like psychologists call this flow. That's the mental state you have to be in to solve a cube fast, because like when I solve it, I'm doing about 60 different things. And you're doing, you know, on average, like 3 things a second if you're under 20 seconds. And so time itself kind of dilates. You have to get in this very meditative headspace. And so ironically, it's very Taoist. Like the faster you try to go, the slower you go. You have to try to not go so fast to get faster.
So many other things have come along since the Rubik's Cube was invented almost 40 years ago. A lot of them can be done on our phones. Why do you think the cube remains popular all these 40 years later?
So this is a question I actually have really enjoyed asking people I've met along the journey of this book, because it was kind of the question for me of, like, why is this diminutive piece of plastic proof so enduring when so many other things had a shorter shelf life? And I think the fact that you can't reduce it to any one answer is the answer. I mean, the Rubik's company has tried to digitize this, and it never succeeded. They've made apps, they've made digital versions of this, but there's something about the combination of it being tactile, it having colors. It's one of these few objects where you don't need to know anything. You don't need to know a particular language to enjoy it. I found an old photograph of kids in the Amazonian jungle playing with this.
We have about 10 or 15 seconds to go. Can you do it right?
I'll try to do it real quick.
Do it while I'm telling people that my guest has been Ian Scheffler. His book, Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. It's published by Touchstone. You have about 11 seconds to go.
Okay, I think we'll get there.
Okay, very close. And there you are, close. Nope.
There we go.
Okay, made it just in time.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for being on our show.